Good evening. Thank you all very much for coming out here to, today. We hope that you will not regret it. We have a rookie speaker up here. This is another Keep Thinking event. We've done lots of different lectures. We just try to thread them together, say the same people are hosting them, so we call them Keep Thinking. Basically, we're just interested in different questions that lots interest any thinking person, and especially things that you ought to think about and reflect on as a college student. So we've invited Dr. Reeves to come speak today. He is a professor in the Electrical and Computer Engineering Department here, has emphases in signal processing and stuff like that. He does a lot with MRI, the center over on College Street, Donahue. He did his bachelor's and master's degree at Clemson University and his PhD at Georgia Tech. I'm not positive, but if Georgia Tech plays Auburn, you root for Auburn, right?
Go Auburn.
But if Auburn plays Clemson, you root for Clemson, isn't that right?
Have to.
Yeah. So, well, you may can let it go for Clemson. He's been here for 25 years. In addition to being a professor, he is a husband. His wife also has a PhD from Georgia Tech in chemical engineering, I believe. Yeah, and she is a expert stay-at-home mom. They have six kids, one of which is on a graduate from Auburn. The second oldest is a student here in industrial engineering, and he's got four more. What's the youngest? How old's Barrett?
Seven
years old. So a lot of spectrum there. He's also a pastor and I would say the founder. You might just say he led the founding of a small Southern Baptist church here, Grace Heritage Church. So quite diverse. Most recently, a recent project of his is he took the 1689 Second London Baptist Confession of Faith and reworded it into modern English. So, along his signal processing and math class that we all loathe, he works on stuff like that. I'll let you remind us all of the topic and the title when you get up here, Dr. Reeves, but will you join me in thanking him for coming?
I also want to thank you for coming. I know that most of you are probably educationally exhausted right now after the end of the semester. It's a difficult time to come and be thinking about anything that you didn't have to come and think about. So I definitely appreciate you being here. The topic is Santa, the Tooth Fairy, and God. Now, that was my title. The subtitle was so long, Brandon came up with the subtitle. I can't even remember what it was exactly, but it's something like, is faith a failure to come to grips with education? Okay, so that's the kind of thing I wanted to address tonight. My 10-year-old son, Lewis, came into our bedroom a few days ago and said, with the most pitiful look on his face, something really bad happened. And I was going, now what really bad could have happened in his life, in his world, that I don't know about? And I said, did one of your frogs die? And he said, no, the tooth fairy forgot to come. I was like, oh. Now, when you're on your fifth child going through tooth fairy stuff, you know, it's kind of, I hope it's understandable that those things slip through the cracks sometimes. But he was kind of, you know, just teasing us a little bit. Really, he just wanted his money. Tooth fairy, forget about that. Just give me my money. And, you know, even as a 10-year-old, Lewis is old enough to realize that the tooth fairy is just make-believe. But that raises a question that I want. That's why I put that in the title. As we get older and wiser and more educated and see through these childish fantasies like the tooth fairy, wait, I hope I didn't, but now, shouldn't we also be giving up the idea that there's a God? Isn't that along the same lines as believing in the tooth fairy? Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, argued that when we become adults, we're afraid to face all the uncertainties of life that we were shielded from when we were children, so we create the illusion of God as a fairy tale parent to watch over us and take care of us. It may be that this is just another myth to kind of help us through life. Christopher Hitchens, the outspoken atheist and the author of God Is Not Good, said this: "Religion comes from the bawling and fearful infancy of our species and is a babyish attempt to meet our inescapable demand for knowledge, as well as for comfort, reassurance, and other infantile needs. Today, the least educated of my children knows much more about the natural order than any of the founders of religion." Okay? So, is it true that education can and should eliminate the silly, childish notion of God, just as it takes away Santa and the Tooth Fairy? Well, on the surface, it might seem that that is exactly what tends to happen. Now, I imagine that many of you have had the experience of encountering an aggressively anti-Christian professor who seemed to be on a mission to expunge the last vestige of any faith that you may have inherited from your childhood upbringing. At least that seems to be the stereotype sometimes of certain professors. Now, even if professors aren't overtly anti-religious, you rarely hear them affirm a religious commitment in the classroom, and that sometimes leaves the impression that few people who attain to the high ranks of academia have any place for childish notions of religion in their lives or in their thinking. My own experience as a professor, I think, bears this same idea out. When I introduce myself at the first day of class, I try to tell them a little bit about my background. I tell them a little bit about my family, and I usually mention that I'm a Christian in that whole introduction. And I regularly hear from students that I'm the only professor that they've ever had who publicly identified himself as a Christian. In fact, I had one student who was so shocked by that claim that he came later to my office and he wanted to know, what did I mean by Christian? And he wanted to know how I became one. And it was like, do you really believe in God? Yes. Do you believe that Jesus is God and also man? Yes, I do. And I also believe that Jesus died and he rose from the dead, and I believe that he suffered the punishment from God that I deserve because of my sins. And I went on, and finally I think I was able to convince him that I really am a Christian. In his world, being both a PhD and a Christian seemed somehow mutually exclusive. He just could not compute that someone could be both. And so he had to verify to make sure before he actually believed what I claimed. Now, I noticed later on, I thought about this. It was kind of odd. He never asked me to see my diploma. You know, maybe I was just an imposter professor. Maybe I don't really have a PhD. So that's another way to reconcile that seeming contradiction. Anyway, the statistics seem to bear out the same impression in some ways. If you look at statistics about education and religious faith, according to one U.S. study, 97% of people with a high school diploma or less believe in God or a universal spirit. And that goes down to 94% if the person has had some college. It goes down to 93% if a person has a college degree, and it goes down to 88% if you have a graduate degree. And then if you ask the question, is religion very important in your life? Then 65% of those with a high school diploma or less say yes, but that falls down to 53% if you have a graduate degree. So there is something going on there. And we can see other studies that show similar kinds of decreases. Now, that would all be just a matter of trivial interest, I think, if that was really all that mattered. Is it just purely the question of whether educated people are less likely to believe in God? But I think there's an underlying question here that's below that surface question, and that is, does education itself somehow reveal or demonstrate to people that faith has no foundation? Maybe that's what's going on. And, of course, the atheists want to point to that and say, see, more educated people don't believe in God. And then those who have faith want to try to maybe explain that away. So, in other words, does education show us that faith in God is just a fairy tale, a story that's suitable only for gullible, uneducated people? Well, I think you should probably guess that my answer to that is going to be a resounding no. I don't believe that education itself kills faith. Now, there are many factors that influence educated people concerning their views of religion and in terms of what makes them change their views of religion. Some people are challenged and they lose their faith as they grow in education, and others begin or deepen their faith as they grow in education. For every Richard Dawkins who grew up in a Christian home and then later rejected his faith and became an atheist, as he became more educated, there's probably a C.S. Lewis out there who moved from atheism to Christianity as he read more broadly. In fact, Lewis puts an interesting spin on this, because he says, and tells of how he became a Christian, he says, a young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading. All the books were beginning to turn against me, he said. Well, regarding the statistics I mentioned, the reality is a little broader than that, and it's actually a little more confusing than that. If you're interested, go to Wikipedia and read the article called Religiosity in Education. Don't do it now, please. as you read through this, it seems like every study that you read about in there, every summary of every study seems to contradict the previous one. And it's kind of all over the map. And it's really hard to put together anything about what's going on. It seems to depend on who you ask and what kind of question you ask. As an example, studies show that the more educated people are, the more likely they are to attend religious services regularly. So that seems kind of the opposite of the statistic I just gave you earlier. Well, I think the key issue can be explained with an illustration. Last summer I did a really interesting experiment. And it wasn't just intended to be an experiment. I was actually teaching a class. So I gave the students the option to either take the class online or take the class in person. And the way they took it, it was not that much difference between the two. The online students would watch video lectures, and they only had to show up for major tests and the final exam. That was it. Okay? They could get help from me online or whatever. Those that took the in-person choice basically did the same thing. They watched all the lectures online as well, but they were required to show up once a week and do problems, like a problem session in class, and take a quiz in class. Okay, that was the only difference, really, between the two. And what's interesting was that at the end of the semester, the students who had chosen to take the class in person had a 0.7 higher GPA than the group who had decided to take it online. 0.7 out of 4. That was that much difference between the two groups. And I was really surprised by that, and I really found it hard to believe that one day of class a week really made 0.7 of a point difference in people's GPA. And so I got kind of curious about that, and I went to our academic counselor and I asked her to give me the cumulative GPAs of all the students that were in my class. This was their GPAs before they took my class. And so I broke them into those two groups, and I averaged the GPAs of the ones that had chosen the in-person mode, and I averaged the ones that took the online mode. And guess what? The difference between those two was almost the same as the difference between the GPAs of those two groups in my class. In other words, my class didn't make the difference. That one day of brilliant problem solving and so forth, it did not really make the difference. What made the difference was that those students were already different, and the ones that really wanted to work hard and learn more and were more diligent and were better students, those are the ones that chose the in-person mode. They knew it was going to be more work, but they chose it anyway. The ones that said, this sounds easier, I'll take the online mode, those students were, on average at least, not as good a student. Okay? And so I think if we look at this issue, we can see the same idea. And that is that when it comes to education and faith, people self-select themselves into different groups. It's not the education that's making the difference. It's the person already that is different. So you think about this. People who are willing to leave home and go to a university for 4 years away from home, they've already shown that they are more independent thinkers than people who are not willing to do that. So you got a pretty different group of people from the start, right there. Okay. They're probably more willing to question their parents than the ones who stayed home. And in a culture that's dominated by Christianity, that means that they're more willing to question their parents' faith. And I think this dynamic is even more pronounced when it comes to faculty. Because faculty, as you well know, are people who pride themselves on thinking creatively and independently. In fact, our jobs depend on being able to do that. So it's not too surprising to find faculty taking a position that goes against the status quo. Sort of take pride in going against the status quo. If you go with the status quo, that may be an indication you're not thinking, right? So to go against the status quo is a badge of honor that you're thinking on independently, on your own. And so it's not surprising then that when faculty take a position against the status quo, in our culture, that means many times taking a position against the dominant religion of the culture. In communist countries, what we find is that academics often get into trouble for criticizing communism. Well, the status quo in communist countries is communism, so they tend to criticize communism because that is the status quo there. And not only that, but I think you'll also find that if you look at the demographic of faculty in an institution like Auburn, the faculty come from are a much more diverse group than the student population is. And so whereas a lot of the students are kind of concentrated in the Bible Belt, the faculty are from all over the world, and they have never had any particular, as a group anyway, haven't had the same level of commitment to Christianity or maybe any religion. So I also think that a false impression is given by a lot of faculty who just don't mention religion at all. There's a silent group of people out there. And some of them may be Christians, but they don't see Christianity as being relevant to their subject. They tend to think of truth as being compartmentalized between religious truth over here and secular truth over there, and there's no need to mention that. So, but then there's also people who are afraid, they don't know their legal rights very well, and they're just afraid that they may get into trouble legally by saying something about religion in the classroom, or they don't want to be called into a talk with the dean or something like that, so they just avoid talking about it altogether. And so all that leaves people with the impression that Christian faculty or religious faculty of any sort are indeed a rare breed. But that's really not, I mean, often not the truth. Or not the whole truth. And at Auburn, there are many Christian faculty. Did any of you see the ad in the Plainsman for Easter about the resurrection from the Christian faculty group? If you didn't, I'm going to show it to you right now. This was from the Plainsman right the week before Easter. And right here is a list of Christian faculty who are willing to put their names on the ad saying, "We believe that Jesus rose from the dead." Okay? And so this is, I don't know, 40-something names. Some of them are professional staff, and others are faculty. But that's here at Auburn, and that's just the people who heard about the ad ahead of time and chose to put their name in the paper. There are probably many who, for one reason or another, just chose not to. Well, I've had the opportunity to observe faculty for nearly 25 years here at Auburn as a faculty member, and my observation is that having a PhD after your name doesn't make you smart about everything. I'm afraid that I've done one or two kind of stupid things in my life. And if you don't believe me, just ask my wife. And, well, don't ask her. No, on second thought. That'd be a whole other talk right there. And I've observed that lots of other faculty do some kind of stupid things too, you know. And so, generally speaking, I see that faculty are really smart in their narrow area of expertise, but when it comes to the rest of life, they're not that much different from the rest of us, even though a lot of them maybe like to think that they are. Okay. So, the bottom line is that our response to religion, at least to Christianity, I think has very little to do with intellect. In fact, I think there are some principles, if if you understand the claims of Christianity, you'll see that it does address this very issue. The Apostle Paul said very specifically that not many of his converts were wise, and not many were powerful, and not many were upper-class people. He said that right out. Okay, he wasn't trying to hide anything about the cross-section of who came to Christ. But he also said there was a reason for that. And the reason was that God did that on purpose to rule out any boasting. Okay, there's a reason. He didn't want anybody going around bragging that they got into a special club because of how smart or how powerful they were. And you know that's exactly what would happen. In fact, just think about how we would view Christianity if it was just mostly PhDs. We would say it's exclusivistic, it's elitist, it's not for everyday people. Okay? So instead of trying to say, well, you know, is it intellectually credible, we would be trying to say, well, you know, it's okay for ordinary people to be involved in it. We wouldn't be, so the fact that Christianity is attractive to people of all educational levels, as I understand that, that's an asset to Christianity. That is not a liability of Christianity. Well, there's a false idea out there that we can evaluate the truth claims of Christianity from a neutral position, that we just come to it without any biases one way or the other. But if we allow that Christianity is even possibly true, we have to consider what it says about our biases when we evaluate information. So according to the Apostle Paul, we come to the table with our minds already hostile to God. We're not neutral. We're already against what God is trying to do and what He is claiming. When we're told that we have to do certain things that we didn't want to do, and we're told to stop doing some things that we really like to do, then we're going to resist that. And when we are told that there's absolutely no hope for us unless we recognize that we really do deserve God's anger, and that we're so hopelessly messed up on the inside that we need supernatural power to straighten us out, well, that's really hard to swallow too. And we're going to resist that. So, the specific reaction of a hostile intellectual, the specific reaction of a hostile intellectual and a hostile non-intellectual to all that might look a little bit different. Because, you know, intellectuals like to have intellectual reasons for everything they do. Non-intellectuals don't necessarily care. That's not where their pride is and their identity is, and so they don't care so much about having intellectual reasons for everything. So a non-intellectual who hears the demands of Christianity and the claims of Christianity might just say, oh, that's not for me. Go and do something else. You know? And they may not do that in an overt way, because they may still want to kind of fit into the culture, so they might even go to church, they might use the language and all that, but they just kind of go on and do whatever they want to do. But an intellectual can't live like that. They can't look in the mirror and just say, I don't have good reasons. Logical, laid out reasons for everything I do. And so then they will probably pay a lot more attention to questions that they have about Christianity, raising issues and things that And use that then to conclude that it can't possibly be true. So the non-intellectual might end up looking just like an inconsistent Christian, and the intellectual looks more like a consistent non-Christian. But in neither case are they really buying it. So I'd like to turn the tables just a little bit. I don't believe there's any evidence that education itself kills faith. In fact, I would assert that faith, and let me qualify that is faith in Christ, rightly understood and rightly applied, actually fuels true education. Okay. And so let me mention two principles and then a few examples. So first of all, the Bible assigns to humanity an incredibly honorable role in His creation. That is, we are made in God's image. And so that gives us a tremendous privilege to represent God and to mirror, in a sense, in some small finite way, what God is like. And one of the things he's done is assigned us to be stewards of the earth, to what the Bible calls rule and subdue, or to cultivate the earth. So we have to learn how the world works, and then we use whatever we've learned to bring order, beauty, and enjoyment to the world. It's part of what we do. It's an incredible opportunity for that. So a Christian who just wants to live off of others and entertain himself all the time has missed the fact that he has a calling in this life. And I think that this principle has meant over the centuries that Christianity has actually played a very large role in the development of the scientific method and in scientific advances. That there are certain preconditions to thinking scientifically that simply can't exist outside, so that science can't exist outside of those preconditions. And Christianity has provided an incubator for many of those ideas that allow science to proceed. And if you're interested in reading more about that, there's a good book called The Soul of Science, Christian Faith and Natural Philosophy by Nancy Christie and Charles Thaxton, and it's actually in the Auburn Library, at least the last time I checked. So we can study the world with confidence that there's meaning and there's purpose to be found in it, and it is possible then for our abstract models, our math, our various abstract concepts and so forth, to actually fit the real observable world around us. Okay? And so we can make sense of it and explain it and make predictions and so forth. So it's a beautiful thing when the right tool comes in and does the right job. And that's true when you're working in the shop. It's also true when your mind has been made by God to grasp the world around you, not fully, of course, but in some small way, and move forward. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the Bible says that the greatest commandment is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So that means if we're to love God with our minds, then we better develop our minds. We better have sharp minds. And we must love Him with our minds, not just by thinking about God and loving Him in that way, but also by using our minds to think and do good things that He made us to do. And so that means we ought to encourage sharpening that tool so that that tool is a good tool in loving God with our mind. So if you're a Christian student and you're sitting there moaning and griping about the circuits homework that Brandon assigned to you, you need to think about this, and you need to picture Brandon and Dr. Reeves hovering over you and saying, "Is this any way to love God with all your mind?" Because you've been given a great gift of learning how to harness electricity. And so go out and learn how the world works, master it, and use it to honor your God. Let me just briefly mention a few individuals who have been noteworthy both for their education and their Christian faith. And I want to start with the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul was highly educated. He demonstrated through his writings in the Bible a knowledge of Stoic philosophy, Greek literature and poetry, the Old Testament. He stood toe-to-toe with intellectuals at Athens, people who did nothing all day long except dialogue with other philosophers. And at one point, Paul appeared before a ruler to explain what he was doing and what he was preaching and this message that he was carrying. And when he started talking about Jesus rising from the dead, you know what this ruler said to him? He didn't say, "Paul, did you flunk out of first grade? What's the matter with you? Go get an education." What's ironic is he said, "No." He said, "Paul, you are out of your mind. Your great learning is driving you out of your mind." Okay? The very opposite of what people today accuse Christians of, who say outlandish things like a man rising from the dead. Well, we could talk about many, many people through the centuries, and it's really hard to even pick people. I'll just mention a couple that I will share quotes from. Both Galileo and Kepler were astronomers who lived about the same time. Galileo said he studied the heavens, because he says the book of nature is written by the hand of God in the language of mathematics. He understood that there's a connection between the abstractions of math and the observations of the created order. Kepler said, "The chief aim of all investigations of the external world should be to discover the rational order and harmony which has been imposed on it by God." We could talk about many others who operated out of a Christian worldview. Scientists like Francis Bacon, Blaise Pascal, James Clerk Maxwell, Lord Kelvin, and many others. Let me also mention an American, Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards was a pastor and theologian in the 1700s. He's well known for his contributions to sort of the theologian of the First Great Awakening. Edwards entered Yale at 13 and graduated at 17. Later on, he became the president of Princeton University, and you might say he sacrificed his body for science, because at that time the smallpox vaccine was a brand new thing and he was convinced it was a good thing, and he volunteered to take it, and he died because of it. But Edwards is widely acknowledged to be America's most important and original philosophical theologian, and his contributions are huge. On today's scene, I'll mention Alvin Plantinga. He's a professor emeritus of philosophy at Notre Dame. When he began his career, almost all the philosophy at that time was dominated by scientific naturalism. And under his leadership and that of others, theism has grown considerably among philosophy departments to the point where it is considered respectable again. And now it's estimated that between a fourth and a third of philosophy professors are now theists, and many of those, most of those, are Orthodox Christians. So, is Christian faith just another story alongside the Tooth Fairy and Santa Claus? Not according to some of the greatest minds in the history of the world. So unless we see educated individuals advocating for belief in the Tooth Fairy and sincere believers dying for their belief in Santa Claus, I don't think there's any concern that Christianity is on the same level as Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy or some other silly children's story. So faith, at least in the Christian sense, has nothing to fear from education. In fact, faith is not ultimately an issue of intellect, but it's of humbling ourselves before God and what he says about our condition and his provision. And education has everything to gain from Christianity, rightly understood and applied. So open your books and love God with all your might.